Empire Podcast this week, we say hello goodbye to Himesh Patel, star of Yesterday. Plus, Peter Strickland, director of In Fabric, drops by, as is the fashion. All that and more on the Movie Podcast. I couldn't live in a world where the Beatles never existed. Imagine it. No frog chorus. Imagine that.
Aye, aye.
Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues. Of such lethal cunning, both of whom, because Helen O'Hara's not here, it's one of those big old swinging sausage fests we have in the podcast every now and again. I'm joined by Ian Freer, film legend, film guru, BAFTA-winning Ian Freer.
Hello, Christopher, how are you?
How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm not too bad, And James Dyer's here as well, which is nice, I guess. We're in a lovely tiger t-shirt.
Thanks. Yes, I am. I'm not as Helen, I'm sure, is at the moment, braiding flowers into her hair and popping disco biscuits and doing whatever it is that one does at a music festival. I wouldn't know. I'd never been.
I'm sure she's off her face listening to Fal Dunigan and such. Or maybe the Travelling Wilburys. So whoever it is headlining Glastonbury this year, I haven't really been keeping up with the current trends in popular music.
I do believe Janelle Monáe is headlining one night.
Really?
Yeah.
In the what they call the Empire Podcast lot at Glastonbury. If you if you headline on Saturday nights, then that's what they call... You know, if you're closing the whole thing down, like if when you get off stage and there's no one left but the cleaner, that's the Empire Podcast lot. So, well done them. Speaking of that, before we get into this week's question, so we're doing a live show, September 14th, Saturday, September 14th, in the Janelle Monáe slot at the London Podcast Festival. We're on the first or second Saturday. I'm never entirely sure. I could probably look it up. But we're going to have a live show. It's going to be fantastic. We're going to have incredible guest, bracket S, close bracket, question mark. We shall see.
If people have never been to the live podcast,
yes.
How different, or what's the difference?
Have you ever been to a live podcast, Ian?
I've never been to a live podcast, no.
You're missing out, Ian.
We do them naked. I mean, that's the main difference.
Naked, but under clothes. And what else do we do? They're a bit...
Is it swearier?
It's much swearier. It's a bit ruder. They're looser. They're goosier.
Okay.
You just get that live vibe, don't you? You just, you know, you feed off the audience. What else? We have good guests.
Yeah.
We have spot prizes, usually. So we have if you come along, if you buy a ticket, which you can do via www.kingsplace.co.uk. You can come along and you might get a spot prize. You might not.
Amazing.
But that depends on you. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. There's a different energy to the ones that we're doing in studio. Boring in studio.
Okay, sounds
great.
When is it again?
Can't remember. Saturday, September 14th. So kingsplace.co.uk, and it's an incredible lineup this year. So once again, they're doing this offer where if you buy tickets to three or more shows, then you will get 15% off. So that is...
It's a decent discount.
Worth it. It is a decent discount.
Could you suggest two other shows people could,
yes,
could book?
Yes, I absolutely could. So Best Pick Podcast is doing a live show there, and that is a podcast that is dedicated to the Best Picture Oscar winners throughout the years.
That's a great one.
That's a great
fantastic
idea for a podcast.
Brilliant.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Also, Sam Clements, a friend of the show, his 90 Minutes or Less Film Festival podcast.
Yeah, that's great.
Also doing a live show.
I'd love to do Jewel on that. I'd love to go and talk about Jewel.
Is that less than 90 minutes, Ian?
It's 90 minutes exactly.
No way.
Yeah.
Would that count? Well, I guess it's 90 minutes less, right?
It's up to Sam Clements, isn't it, really?
But, yeah. Sam Paul Clements, line, if you're listening to this, then Ian Freer would like to go on and talk about Jewel. And believe me, what Ian Freer doesn't know about Spielberg ain't worth knowing. So get him on your show, Sam.
Are there any TV podcasts you'd recommend?
No, nothing springs to mind.
Fair enough,
So if you want to get tickets then to... Sorry, James, were you...
No.
Do you want to say something?
No.
Oh, wait. No, I do know of one. There is a Friends with Friends podcast, which is dedicated... No, it is Pilot TV. They're doing... They're our warm-up. You're the fluffer, if you will.
We are.
Yeah.
The night before.
The night
Friday
before.
Night.
Yeah.
And is that you, Terry White, and Boyd Hilton?
It is.
Right.
Plus, possibly, a special celebrity guest.
I don't promise anything.
Really?
The advantage that I have is that I just get Boyd to call one of his many celebrity friends, say, can you ask insert name here to come along and talk to the audience for a bit? So that's what we're going to do.
Can you do that for us?
Yeah.
I haven't actually asked any guests yet to do the September
slot. It'll just be Boyd's mates across both podcasts.
It's a bit tricky because you have to go, basically, would you like to come along to do a live show? And sometimes they'll go, yeah, that sounds like fun. And then you go, it's Saturday night? Oh, okay. I kind of have plans. It's 9:30. So they go, oh, no, I'm busy that night. So, you know, it may just be us, me in a wig.
We may have locked down the pilot one, but I don't want to confirm until he, she has signed in blood in the contract.
Great. So you're on Before Empire.
Yes.
That's a great double
bill. Been the night before.
Same slot, previous
day.
Yeah. Okay, right.
They're not like a support group or anything, But yes, Pilot TV. Right. We were stalling because we're trying to get a question on Twitter. Oh, here's a good one from @ILoveThatFilm. Pete Turner on Twitter says, look at your shiny crystal balls, please. Once Endgame knocks Avatar off the top spot this weekend, because Avengers Endgame is being re-released this weekend.
Yep.
Have you seen what it's being re-released with? I mean, last week
it's a free poster.
And some deleted scenes.
An
unfinished deleted scene.
Yeah.
An introduction from one of the Russos. Couldn't even get both of the Russos. And basically, that's it. A warm handshake from a Marvel executive on your way out.
Do you think the introduction will just be one of the Russos saying, we say it came so close to being the biggest movie of all time, we didn't quite make it, so thanks for coming back to push us over the edge in this incredibly cynical re-release marketing move?
Yeah, why not? Well, you also get a sneak peek of Spider-Man Far From Home, which opens in 5 days. 4 days. So, I don't know, that doesn't get me in the cinema.
As a fan, do you care whether it's the number one box office film or not?
I think a lot of people do. There's a quite tribal thing going on.
Making the biggest movie of all time.
Okay.
You know, like you want your football team. Oh, no, don't worry. I'm not going to turn this into a football thing.
Thank God.
But you want your football team to be the best football team, right? But some people want the bands that they like to be that underground band that nobody else likes, you know?
Yeah.
No one's really thinking that about Endgame at this point.
You put this cool indie movie I discovered.
Yeah. Really niche, open, small at Sundance. A couple of people saw it.
But this whole big debate, but I don't understand where the tribalism comes from. Why can't I like Avatar and...
Because you can't, Ian.
You're not loud,
for
Ian.
For fuck's sake.
You're not loud.
Okay.
Honestly, Ian, did you not
pick
get the memo?
Side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have, it's one or t'other. One or t'other. Where are you? Are you Avengers or are you Avatar?
Titanic.
He's one of them.
He is one of them.
He's one of them.
I have to keep an eye on this
one of them.
Anyway, the question is
at some point,
once Endgame knocks Avatar off the top spot this weekend, what future film will ever stand a chance of taking more than Endgame does?
Right. Do we think the end of Star Wars saga?
No.
No? Okay.
Well, surely post-Brexit it'll cost like £99 for a cinema ticket. So actually every single film.
All right. What about, and you're going to laugh, Frozen 2?
How many snowmans can one film build?
Interesting.
No.
Interesting.
No?
No.
And is there anything in the Marvel pipeline you think could dethrone Endgame?
No. Actually, weirdly enough, no.
I think give it time. Because it's like the thing is, like, Endgame's a difficult thing. Endgame is like the Game of Thrones finale. Like, it's 20 films in the making. Like, it's a big old event movie. I'm not saying that Marvel... In fact, I absolutely believe Marvel will come with something that's as big, but it's going to take time. It takes time to build up to it. So whatever the next Extinction Agenda / House of M / whatever it is that they come up with in however many films' time, possibly.
Yeah. So James Cameron have to come up with his Avatar ad for the biggest film of all time.
Here's a decent question. Do we think Avatar 2 will stand a chance? I can't see it happening, to be honest.
But I think that's Cameron's genius, isn't it? In that no one saw Terminator 2 coming. Everyone thought it was going to be lousy. He's brilliant at upping the stakes.
He's
on
brilliant
the
at everything.
Yeah.
And there's a part of me that thinks Avatar was a conjunction of the spheres. You know, it was an unimaginable alignment of events. So, repeat viewing, cinema ticket prices for 3D, the return of 3D, it becoming this sort of four quadrant thing that no one had seen before. And you can't really repeat that, but it's just like...
He'll find a way.
It's James Cameron.
He will find a way.
Yeah. I think I know how he's going to do it.
Yeah?
Go on.
He's a billionaire. He'll just buy a billion tickets.
He could do that.
This is what he's been... building this huge fortune. He's been accruing all this cash over the years. So if Avatar 2 comes out in December 2021, it's currently scheduled. That's a movable feast, but we think that's when it's going to come out. So say it comes out then, and it's only getting about 1.2 billion or so, he'll just go to the old piggy bank, pick it up, dump out another one cool 1.5 bill, and there you go, gets it over the line.
Exactly.
Speculate to accumulate.
And Kevin Feige's coming up with the adverts congratulating him, isn't he? Iron Man says, well done.
All right. So I think we've answered that to Pete Turner's satisfaction. Here's another one from Aaron Elliott @AJ_Elliott91 on Twitter. What's a reasonable amount of times a person can get away with saying they just have something in their eye while watching Toy Story 4? And this is interesting because we were just weirdly chatting about Toy Story 4 before we began the show. And I think you've asked the wrong people.
Yeah.
I think we were all
I had nothing
unmoved.
In my eye except eyeballs.
I mean, what would make you cry in Toy Story 4? And we have to be obviously careful. It's only just come out, so that's tiptoe around spoilers. But
I think it's moments.
Sweet.
There's two moments towards the end where you can conceivably have a little cry.
Okay.
I mean, I'm a big old wuss baby when it comes to good Pixar. It's like I wailed through Coco. I can't make it through for 15 minutes of art without falling on the floor and wailing again.
See, Coco didn't get me either.
But I just, Toy Story 4 left me absolutely cold. It felt to me like a mixtape of Toy Story moments. It peaks with Toy Story 3 and will ever be thus.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Up was the last Pixar movie to extract fluid from me, and there won't be a second. Final question here is from @ReeseLipman. Last night, I was lucky enough to meet all the heads of Aardman.
Wow.
Yeah, Aardman is one guy, but he has 17 heads. Yeah. I realize they've probably impacted me more than any other studio, being one of the reasons I work in film now. Which production companies have impacted you or your reason for working in film the most? And he even says in Amblin, etc.
Absolutely.
Almost as if he knew he were going to be on the show.
Absolutely. So I would say Amblin. I first went to Amblin in 2002 for what was Spielberg's latest film, which was Minority Report. And that was a pilgrimage. That was absolutely me going to the most important thing in my life. So unforgettable stuff.
Okay, that's
good. What about you, James?
I mean, it's obvious, isn't it?
You've been to Skywalker Ranch.
It's Lucasfilm, isn't it? I mean, it's obviously Lucasfilm. Yes, it is. Like, I grew up obsessed with the Star Wars movies. I have been to Lucasfilm. I've been to Skywalker Ranch. I've done all that. In fact, I did it with you, Ian. So this is not news to you.
No, but you've been what many people haven't been. You've been in the archives of Skywalker Ranch.
I have. We were both in the archive, yes. Yeah. It was very, very exciting.
Which was full of absolutely any kind of Star Wars memorabilia you could imagine.
Yeah.
But the thing that got me was the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, the Ark. And the Grail is there as well. The fucking Grail.
Yeah. And it's not a fancy thing. It's a humble thing like a carpenter would
make. That's right. That's right. Howard the Duck is there.
Yeah.
Remember that? They had the original mats from the Raiders film, the indie films from Return of the Jedi.
And what was the Star Wars thing that stood out for you?
Oh, remember when they brought out the case with the original lightsaber hilts in it? That was pretty exciting. It's like bring out this metal case, open it up and packed in foam. You've got all the hilts, the original hilts. The idol from the beginning of Raiders there as well.
Yeah.
Remember that? The Grail Diary. In fact, there were loads of them, as I recall, like a little stack of Grail Diaries.
Yeah.
Stunt diaries, presumably.
I wonder if that's because Mr. Bronson has to sign them.
Exactly.
In Last Crusade. So maybe they just had loads.
In case he froze them, yeah.
Yeah, that time that Mr. Bronson from Grange Hill, if you don't know what that is a British TV show for kids set in a comprehensive school. And Mr. Bronson was one of the teachers, and he is, what's his name in real life?
Admiral Ozzel.
That's it, Admiral Ozzel in real life. Wasn't it Michael Sheard.
Yeah.
Michael Sheard in real life, and he plays Hitler in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You know that iconic scene?
Yes, yes I do.
Where Indiana Jones could kill Hitler in World War II and he doesn't. That one.
And what production company or house have you been to?
I think you've taken them in. Well, the question's really about which has impacted you or your reason for working in film the most. It's kind of evolved, really. I'm going to say Amblin as well, because when you're growing up, when I was growing up, Amblin was one of the few companies I was aware of.
Yeah.
When you see that logo at the beginning of a movie, you know that you're usually in for a good time and you're aware of Steven Spielberg's connection to it. And apart from maybe Imagine, Ron Howard and Brian Grazer's Imagine, and obviously Jerry Bruckheimer Productions Don Simpson, Jerry Bruckheimer Productions, I don't think I was really aware of
Carolco.
Silver Pictures, but Carolco is not a production company. But Carolco, I guess. Carolco.
Because they had all Terminator and Rambo, and had all those great 80s films had that at the beginning. So I always associated the little swirly C motif.
Or Orion.
Yes.
Orion Pictures, RIP.
Yeah.
So all these things, they all seemed glamorous, didn't they? They all seemed like they were doorways to this incredibly glamorous world
of
films.
Not so much
Morgan
Creek, but
obviously since I started working for Empire, the rise of Marvel and things have impacted my working life in huge ways. But it's Amblin. It's Amblin. What's their offices like? Is it?
Well, when you arrive outside, there's a wishing well. If you have a peek in, there's a shark inside. Then it's kind of like it's only on one floor, and there's a T-Rex, a beautiful T-Rex model outside one of the theatres. There's lots of foreign movie posters of Spielberg's films, plus a lot of classic movie posters. There's a lot of love of movies around. There's an American Beauty Oscar in the foyer.
Is it in a bed of roses? Is it?
I remember that I was there once and I got to watch Anchorman, which they were testing sound on. So I watched a large section of Anchorman months before it came out.
Wow.
When I was there, they let me see there. So, yeah, I have amazing memories of
that. Have you ever been to, did you go to Bad Robot?
No, I've never been to Bad Robot.
Bad Robot's a very cool office.
I've been to Pixar. I've been.
Yep, Pixar, yep.
Pixar. Ding. I've been to Industrial Light and Magic.
Yeah, I've been there.
Ding!
And I've been to Scorsese's cutting room.
Oh,
fuck you. I'm bringing out the big guns now.
Hello. Hello. Yeah.
Which is amazing because he has, I sat waiting for him in his kind of office. It's full of wall-to-wall binded film magazines, Cahiers du Cinéma, Film Comment.
Empire.
One Empire at all. No Empire at all.
Does he not like How Much Is a Pint of Milk? His friend Bobby. Bobby De Niro was once in Pint of Milk, which is the irreverent questionnaire in the magazine. And I chickened out of asking the big question, which is on a scale of 1 to 10, how hairy is your arse? I just felt that I don't think we'd connected and enough.
Do you remember if he knew how much a pint of milk was?
He guessed, I think.
Right.
I think he guessed. But he was quite personable. He was quite
His nickname's Bobby Milk, isn't he, when he was a kid?
What's it?
Yeah, he was called Bobby Milk because he was very pale. So all the neighbourhood kids used to call him Bobby Milk.
Oh, my God. See, this is why we bring you in for Euron. Big guns.
Some facts.
The big guns. All right, okay. So those are the three questions we're going to tackle this week. If you want to have your question or questions read out in the Empire podcast, you can get in touch via a number of methods. We're on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're also on Facebook. I don't even know why I bother even saying Facebook.
No,
I don't know why I bother.
I don't know either. We're not on Facebook.
We are on Facebook.
No, we're not. Just say we're not.
Anyway, we're on Facebook and we're also on email, podcast@empireonline.com, and I do check that one. Right, let's have a guest. Who should we have? We have, you know what, we're going to have Peter Strickland. That's a Peter Strickland. He's a fantastic British director.
Yep.
The likes of Kathleen Farga, Barbarian Sound Studio, The Duke of Burgundy, and now he's back with another slice of weirdness, and it is In Fabric, the film that could equally be known as Phantom Thread, or, if you will, The Fabrizi Strangler is what I thought. But no, this is In Fabric, and it is essentially the tale of a haunted dress, an evil dress, a dress that has the power to kill. And why not? Why bloody not? So Peter Strickland, he's one of the most original, innovative and daring filmmakers around, and we were delighted when he came into this very, very booth to have a good old chat with our good pal, Mr. John Nugent. Do please enjoy.
We are thrilled to welcome Peter Strickland to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're here to talk about your fourth film, In Fabric, which I guess in the simplest terms you could describe as a horror film with it's set in the January sales.
Yes. So
that's a fair description?
That's a fair description, yeah.
What is the genesis for a film like this? Like, you in the queue at Debenhams in January and then you just sort of inspiration struck? Where did it all begin?
I was really into these M.R. James adaptations, which I came to them quite late. The BFI did a re-release of these BBC adaptations. And I just loved this uncanny atmosphere. So really, it was just trying to... I guess you have this kind of fantasy in your head. What if M.R. James wrote about the high street? Pick a setting which is really prosaic and look for the unfamiliar in the familiar, really. And when you start doing that, you really start picturing images such as you say, I mean, what you said is not too far off. If you're doing a stock take at 5 a.m. and you look out the window, there's this kind of eerie, silent queue of people. The mannequins, I remember from the 70s, these very long fingers. And I think a lot of it goes back to my childhood. I think how I saw the world, well, how one sees the world as a kid. And just going back to that, those department stores, which were, they had a different energy from department stores now. They didn't have beats in their music. Sometimes they didn't have music at all. And the carpets were thicker.
Yeah.
And the sound was more muffled. And everything... So you just try to go back to that feeling you had as a kid, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, there was something very nostalgic about watching it, actually. You sort of conjure a Britain that's been forgotten. It's the sort of 1970s, 1980s, almost Thatcherite Britain, I guess.
The strange thing is, it continued up until quite recently. I mean, this was based on Jackson's in Reading, which closed in 2013. When I went there on the last day to take photographs, it was exactly the same as I remembered. It had bits of Edwardian Britain, Victorian Britain, 50s, 60s, 70s. And it had the pneumatic money shoots. And that's something I really remember as a kid, or even as an adult, that you'd have this agonizing wait for your change to return down this chute.
Yeah.
Sometimes you would just leave without your change because you couldn't stand this tension standing opposite the cashier. And but in that time it takes for your money to come back, you start, you know, look at the dumb waiter, maybe that goes somewhere interesting. And so I think when you're waiting so long for something, it activates your imagination a little bit.
Mm. And there's something about the sort of mundanity of that world as well. I guess you set the film in a town called Thames Valley on Thames, which is one of my favourite jokes, I think. I also love the moment where Sheila reads out her full phone number when she answers the phone, which is something that I've seen family members do. Were you drawing from real life experiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a tricky one because I think it's a danger of where is the line between personal and autobiographical, and all my films are personal. But I never wanted to say it's a tricky one. But clearly, you know, I grew up in Reading. I didn't want to be very specific, so I don't want to say it's called Reading. It's Thames Valley on Thames. It's an absurd title, of course. It's like a generic, it could, you know, there's so many on Thames towns. And initially it was a genre piece, you know, and focusing on a curse, a haunting. But when you start writing, other things creep in, which are not intentional. So the humour creeps in, the personal recollections creep in. You use your experience to fuel things. You know, I used to work at TGI Fridays, and on a Saturday morning, you would greet the first customers. Everyone would line up and greet everyone, not in the way they do in the film. Mm. But again, you're exaggerating it. I used to work in retail. I used to wear a shirt saying, I'll help you, on the side. So you're just feeding the film with all that. So I guess, you know, most of the jobs, the vast majority of jobs I had were white-collar jobs. Mm. You know, I was a typical middle-class kid from Reading. On your lunch break, you might go and buy a record or some pair of socks.
Yeah.
I mean, haunted socks wouldn't, you know, they don't fly through the air as nicely as a dress flies through the air. So really, yeah, and I think it's very important to show the work aspect because it shows some of the frustrations you have with management. I should add, it's not just in those jobs, it's also in film as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And yeah, I think the need to escape. So the danger is you could view them as consumerists if you're not spending enough time with them and showing their frustrations.
But was it always, because it is a haunted dress at the centre of this film, was it always a dress? I mean, did you consider socks or trousers? Or, I mean, what did you have a clear vision of what this haunted fabric would be?
Yeah, it had to be a dress. It was mainly about flying through the air.
Okay.
And I guess socks just don't fly through the air that well. But, you know, it led into other aspects. How, I guess, body dysmorphia with Babs, that no matter what size she is, she will hate her body. Mm. And there was this disconnect in her relationship with Reg. He has a hosiery fetish. She doesn't get it. She just can't comprehend it. He doesn't get her. He can't comprehend her obsession with weight. And but still, you know, they work as a couple, but there is that disconnect. And again, I wanted to explore obsessions with clothing, fetishism, grief, the dream that Sheila has of, you know, how difficult it is to get rid of a dead person's clothing, someone who's very close to you. Mm. But also, you know, escape, you know, how you feel transformed when you put on, I guess no one feels transformed when they put on a sock, but something bigger, whether it's a shirt or trousers or a dress, then you can escape yourself, escape your troubles. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. That's quite a human thing. You know, plumage. I mean, animals would do the same.
Yeah.
They could go shopping.
And you get real sense of the texture of the dress, and that it's such a sort of sensual film. You know, what sort of conversations did you have with like your costume designer and your cinematographer about bringing that sort of texture to the screen?
Well, I mean, what dictated that was, I wanted the dress to move like a jellyfish in the air. Mm. So Jo Thompson, who did costumes, she can instantly say, okay, you want chiffon, you want silk, you want a certain sheen, so you get silk. I mean, I'm very bad with fabrics. So I really relied on her and her team to to guide me through it. My notes were mainly about how I want it to move and the type of dress, not in terms of design, but the type of market you're aiming for. So Omar Jackson's is a kind of like a middle class store, but there was this aspirational element. So, you know, it was as if you were imagining being invited to the Spanish embassy for canapes one evening, even though you would never get that invite. So that kind of dress is not high fashion. It's this kind of aspirational middle class. So we're working on that kind of tone, shall we say.
One of the best scenes in the film for me was that when the dress sort of haunts a washing machine, and this washing machine sort of loses control. I mean, how do you put together a scene like that with, you know, I'm assuming your special effects budget isn't massive compared to Marvel or something.
Yeah, and it was difficult, very, very difficult. I mean, there was money to do that. Yeah. But, I mean, that was the special effects team. But it was not enough time. I mean, all these things, a dog attack, 4 hours to shoot it.
Right.
We had longer for the washing machine. We had other takes to do within that. But that shot, we just had one take. That was it.
Oh, wow.
And it was supposed to turn the other way around. The door was rigged to fly open and flood everything, which it did, but you didn't see it fling open. And that was it. You just have to work with what you get, really.
Yeah.
We had 27 days to shoot the film. It sounds like I'm at school making excuses now. But, yeah, I mean, quite often, yeah, you would love things to be better. Some things, for me, I'm really proud of. Other things, you think, oh, we just kind of like, just only got there by the skin of our teeth.
Yeah.
Could have been better, but just have to do it.
But that almost fits, right? The fact that the washing machine was out of control for both Sheila and for you. I mean, there's a sort of parallel there, perhaps.
It's nice of you to say that. I would have preferred another take.
Okay.
I mean, it's partly my fault. I mean, I spent too long on other takes. And, that's just the nature of it. The time it would take to what's the word? I forgot the word for resetting.
Reset, yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
Not a chance.
So the film premiered at Toronto in the midnight slot, right?
Yes.
So how was that? I mean, that feels like a perfect time to watch a film like this. What was the reaction in the room like?
I would say that was one of the best of my life. It was partly because I had such a low beforehand. But I think the combination of having quite a difficult time with the film just before and this elation during the screening, I'd say it was the best screening I've had, actually. It was just incredible. Because I think it was not an easy film to make. There was a lot of stress, I think. If anyone's honest about it, they will say the same. You know, the time frame. I think, yeah, I honestly just did not know how people would react to the film. Certainly, a lot of people who saw it before it came out were like, we don't like this.
really?
You know, so it was just like wonderful, such a huge relief to hear laughter.
Yeah. Why was it such a torturous process then to get it to where we are today? Like, what was the?
Well, the shooting. It was just 27 days.
Yeah.
It was it's only like a few extra days from the Duke of Burgundy, which only had pretty much two, three actors in one setting.
Yeah.
This was a huge amount of settings, 10 times more people. Extras, things I'd never done before, you know, the dog attack, the washing machine, the fight, the fire. So I did feel out of my depth. The crew, I wouldn't say it was very harmonious.
really?
The overwhelming, you know, the vast majority of people were wonderful, really great, hardworking, very talented. But I think, as anyone will say in a film crew, it just takes two or three individuals to be disruptive.
Right.
And to have an attitude. And I mean, the problem is television, that we can't compete with television budgets.
Yeah.
So you'll get one individual who's used to much higher sums of money, much more professionalism perhaps as well. And they look at us who, you know, with my films are pretty chaotic. We're kind of, we're making it up as we go along, even though there's a script. But just to get from A to B on a shoot, you just, a lot of the time, so sometimes I'd say the atmosphere was not good, and I'm not going to lie about it. It was not fun to shoot this film.
Wow.
There were no laughs on set, no.
Really?
So that's why it was so nice in Toronto to go back to what I hoped it would be when I was writing it.
Yeah.
Because when we were making it, it was just, it was quite glum.
Oh, that's such a shame.
But well, we made a film, so I'm happy about that.
I guess it can be quite an abstract thing when you're making a film, I imagine, that it's hard to see the sort of finished product. And then once you've got a finished product now, then it must be a bit of a relief, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, it's a strange one, really. I guess I'm quite selfish in how I make films, but you still make it for an audience.
Yeah.
But I think you can't second-guess an audience. So you're making it for the audience, but you can't tailor it for the audience because you don't know what... You know, everyone's so different. So all you can do is just go into yourself as much as possible. Mm. And I think if any filmmaker goes into themselves... I mean, we're all human beings, so I think what our obsessions and hang-ups and anxieties and all that stuff, someone else will have those. Mm. So I think it's really important to just go in there, and you might not know why you're doing something, but I think as long as you're tapping into yourself, hopefully something will resonate. Of course, you know, you can't, you know, if you do that, you are going to be divisive. That's just the nature of making a film, if you're going into yourself. But hopefully the ones you like it will, you know, be into it quite a bit, I hope, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I just wanted to ask briefly, just to go back a bit, about Bjork, because you obviously directed the Biophilia live concert film. I'm a huge Bjork fan. She seems like, you know, such an amazing artist. What sort of, like, collaborator was she? I imagine she's got very specific vision.
she's very specific.
Yeah.
But it's fine. I mean, when it's my work, when I'm writing, directing, many people would call me arrogant, which I'm fine with. But if I'm doing something for someone else, yeah, I'll do whatever they want.
Okay.
So I was very happy to do whatever she wanted. But actually, she's not that specific. She's specific, of course, but she gives you space to come up with stuff. But even if she was 100% controlling, I wouldn't mind. I have no issue with, you know... It's weird, you know, someone said, oh, you're so pure and you do these films by yourself. But that's only by accident, because I've tried to do TV. I've tried to do,
right,
you know, your basic television series. But I don't get them because people think I'm going to try and do something weird. It's like, no, I would do anything. I would...
You'd do Bill or something. Or...
Absolutely, 100%. Really? Of course I would, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's training, it's practice, it's money. I wouldn't try and make it weird. I would do exactly what I'm told to do.
Okay.
And I don't see the problem with that. I've been called all kinds of names for attempting to do those things.
Yeah.
And I think, fine. I mean, call me a prostitute. I'm happy with that. we all have to live. So I'm only doing the films I do by accident. I would still make my films, but in between, I've always tried to do other work.
Mm.
I just couldn't get it. I couldn't get adverts. I couldn't get TV.
Mm.
So the Bjork thing was great. I was worried about going into it because it was my first commission. It was a co-direction with Nick Fenton. Mm. And it's bad enough making your own film. I'm always having arguments when I make my film. So how the hell am I going to make it work with a co-director? And it was just wonderful. It was just that and The Duke of Burgundy were the most harmonious experiences I've had making work. And between The Duke of Burgundy and In Fabric was 4 years. And that's just punishing.
Yeah.
Even though we tried to do other stuff in between. But things collapse. So, you know, someone said, oh, you had 4 years off. And, no, I didn't have 4 years off. You know, another film I wrote and developed and was casting, and it collapsed, and then In Fabric, and then Night Voltage. So, it's, you know, it's like any other job. You do your Monday to Friday and the occasional Saturday and Sunday. But, you know, I'm not complaining. I mean, I love my job. And I'm very, very lucky to do it. I think you need to do a film. If you're not doing a film every 2 years, it becomes very, very difficult.
Yeah.
And also, I think you just lose, you actually forget things. So when you're on set after 4 years not being on set, it's like you do have to sort of reset yourself and work eyelines. I mean, I'm bad at eyelines at the best of times, but which is why doing television you're constantly in practice. I'm really pushing this TV thing.
Someone will be listening. There'll be a TV producer who desperate for a director. I really hope you get to film something again soon. We're super excited with whatever you come up with next. So, Peter Strickland, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right, so that was Peter Strickland, and now it's time to dig deep into this week's movie news. Ian, have you been keeping up with the movie news? Do you know what's been happening?
Little bits and bobs, yeah.
Yeah, anything on your mind?
Yeah, James Bond.
Okay.
There was a little featurette drop from, that seemed to be following the filming, shooting in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
That looked great.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you know, there was lots of shots of Cary Fukunaga, the director.
I mean, he's a dish, isn't he?
He is, isn't he?
I mean,
is he on your best looking directors list?
If Helen and I, if Helen were here, we'd be lamenting the absence of the Fit Directors feature.
Yeah.
Which may be a book. If anyone's interested in turning this into a book, then do get in touch with me on Twitter at Chris Hewitt. My DMs are open. I am willing to negotiate and get in touch with us. So this is a list of the most attractive directors working in movies these days. We're very, very strict about this, Ian. Can't be actors turned directors.
No, because
they have a head start.
Yeah, exactly.
They have a head. Taika Waititi. Can't.
No.
He looked like that already.
Exactly.
So, no. But Cary Fukunaga, very attractive guy. Yeah. So he features a lot in this, but it's cool, isn't it? So you know, it's cool.
Yeah, it's a very different mood for James Bond, isn't it? There's a kind of a reggae kind of track,
reggae dance music. It's quite hardcore.
Yeah.
Did you throw some shapes while you were
absolutely
watching the
and there's good. It's very rich.
Threw it back out.
Very rich colours. Not a lot of Daniel Craig, has to be said. It's a piece of Daniel Craig.
He's hurt his foot. You see him limping in the background. Yeah. You don't.
And he has a huge kind of harpoon gun, doesn't he, that he kind of comes to interview with.
He's walking along, we see him through the shutters of a house, and I was wondering if that shutter might in fact be Goldeneye. We know that they did the launch, the press launch was at Goldeneye, which is Ian Fleming's house in Jamaica. And I don't know, but I wonder if they shot something there as well. Speculating here, but you also see Lashana Lynch.
Yeah.
This character called Nomi. You see Jeffrey Wright returning as Felix Leiter.
He's a good Felix Leiter, Jeffrey Wright. He's only been in two of them, isn't he?
They missed him, I think, in the last two.
What I'd like to have seen is some stunts or some action.
Yes.
Or some.
There's that one shot of an explosion which looks a lot like second unit B roll. It's just like a long shot of a little poof, as the explosion goes off.
Yeah.
That's it. That's your lot. Oh, isn't there a helicopter as well? There's a helicopter.
That opens with two kind of helicopters, a bit Apocalypse Now, isn't it, going across the frame?
I think it's going to look great. They're trying to present a slightly different face. They're probably also, if we're honest, trying to get out and kind of cut off negative buzz about the movie.
Yeah.
Because it has been assailed by negative buzz. A lot of it stirred up by one of the worst tabloids in this country. In fact, let's be honest, the worst tabloid in this country, which seems to have some sort of weird agenda against the film and is currently constantly kind of digging up dirt or allegations about, you know, all sorts of stuff. But obviously, you know, they had the Daniel Craig injury very, very soon into production. There's all sorts of rumors about what that's done to the schedule.
Yeah.
And I think they've gone, no, we're fine, guys. We're fine. And look what we're doing. And this isn't obviously, there's not a lot of shots from the film itself unless Cary Fukunaga is really going in a different direction and having people staring directly into the camera. Which you might be able to fix in post, you never know.
That's Phoebe Waller-Bridge, isn't it? Kind of doing Fleabag, Fleabag looks the camera, isn't it? Yeah, so this is what this is all about.
Bond
now,
just keeps doing a side.
I'm totally there for it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But yeah, that's exciting. I was excited about that. Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got something as well. I've got a little bit of, well, I've got a lot of news because I do the Alexa update, by the way. And if you don't already listen to that, you should. If you have access to Alexa, whether it's through an Amazon Echo or just the Amazon app on your phone of choice, you can listen every day, every morning, should you so desire, to me giving you the latest movie news. And I can realize that's not an incentive, but you can, should you so desire, just install the Empire Movie News skill on your app or your Amazon device. And we are, I believe, I keep being told this, but we are working to get it available on other platforms, Google
and
such.
It's a mad skill.
It is a mad skill. So do that. And then every day you just go, hey, Alexa, what's the news? And Alexa will go, here is the movie news from Empire Magazine. And then an idiot's voice comes out of the speakers. Anyway, so because I do that, I'm a little bit more up to date on news than I used to be. So I know that Ray Winston has joined the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Okay, who is he playing?
Have a bang on that. Now, I don't know that because he's joined the cast of Black Widow and they're being very secretive about Black Widow to the point where they're not even saying that it exists.
I don't understand about Black Widow.
Neither do any of us.
This is a prequel, is it?
Well, we don't know this. We're assuming that it's a prequel. This was certainly, you know, they've been talking about it as a prequel for a long, long time.
Yeah. I'm more excited about this Marvel film than anyone because I'm a huge Kate Shortland fan.
Good.
And I think she's a genius. And so I think she'll be a great choice to make
if she can fit into the Marvel style, which I think they've shown themselves, I think since the Edgar Wright situation.
Kinda, yeah. I thought that Captain Marvel didn't have enough Bowden and Fleck about it, but you never know, you know. So fingers crossed for Kate Shortland, because she's great.
Fingers crossed for Kate Shortland, indeed.
Yeah, if you haven't seen The Berlin Syndrome, really check it out. It's so exciting. She's a great filmmaker.
Absolutely. So
with your Marvel knowledge, who would you guess that Ray Winston is playing?
I think he's a baddie.
Okay.
I would cast him as MODOK, or MODOK, who is a psychotic giant floating head, because he has experience of it in the Bet365 ads. But otherise, I don't know, because I don't really know where this is going. I think
I would cast him as Mac from Crystal Skull.
Why not?
And just kind of, you know...
Jonesy!
What side is he on? We'll never know. Is he in Hydra? Is he an Avenger? We'll never know.
It's impressive knowledge, in for you, I have to say. See, Marvel's penetrating you.
You have to, don't you?
It's Hail Hydra, Ian.
James, how do you feel about
I'm thrilled to bits. I think she's a great character who has historically been a little underserved. I think that certainly was addressed later on, but if you go back to Iron Man 2, she is not particularly well represented.
That is very, very fair.
Yeah. She's had some great moments since, but I'd love to see a leading round film. I think it's just a shame it's taken this long to get there.
Yes. Right. But it is happening. It is happening right now. It is filming as we speak in London. Kate Shortland is directing. Scarlett Johansson is starring. There's a great cast, Florence Pugh, David Harbour, Ray Winston's just joined. There's still a little bit of up in the airiness about whether Rachel Weisz is on board. Some people say she is, some people say she isn't, but it's a good cast, shaping up in an interesting direction. And now all we need to do is have Marvel actually tell us that it is officially happening, because it's one of those weird things. Like, it's literally happening, guys. It's over there.
We're looking at them shooting it. No.
Nothing to see here.
Nothing to see here. Move along.
So it could be interesting. But yeah, is it a prequel? We'll find out next year. Or will we? We don't know. There's some other cool stuff that's happened this week. Chiwetel Ejiofor, Harry Melling and Veronica Ngoe have also joined the cast of a movie that is shooting right here, right now in London. And it is The Old Guard. It is a Netflix movie based on a graphic novel by Greg Rucka and Leandro Fernandez. And it stars Charlize Theron as Andy, who's the leader of a small group of immortal soldiers who've existed for centuries. They're a secret from the world. And then I think they get outed to the world at the same time as they discover someone else, a new immortal, who I believe is played by Kiki Layne from If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yeah, great. So, she's great.
Is it Highlander, The Next Generation?
It feels a little bit like that, doesn't it? But it sounds really, really cool, and it's got a good cast. As I said, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Charlize Theron. It's directed by Gina Prince-Blythewood. And
wasn't she
I'm
on
excited
that,
about that
Silver and Sable
She
movie
was. Didn't... Black Cat and Silver Sable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Black Cat, Ian and James, as you will know, has just, of course, joined Marvel Puzzle Quest as the latest playable character. Four stars.
Yeah.
That's unlucky. Yeah. Hey!
So very excited about that. That's good stuff.
Do you see that Taika Waititi is doing an animated Flash Gordon? What do we make of that?
That'd be nuts, wouldn't it? I mean, that'd be great.
It's going to be crazy, I would think.
Yeah.
Gordon's alive! That's the worst Brian Blessed that's ever been done.
Who was that?
I don't know. It was one of these things where I thought, I don't know if I can do Brian Blessed. I'm going to go for it. Oh, God, abort! Yeah, didn't go very well.
Gordon's alive!
I mean, that's him now, because, you know, it's like, I imagine him as... It takes its toll being king of the bird people. Yeah. So,
have I told the story in the podcast before? I'm sure I have, and if I have, I apologise. But back in the day, when I was doing my regular slot on Lauren Laverne's show on Six Music, I went to the BBC and I didn't have my pass, and so I was being caught up just waiting to, you know, to get my pass signed off so I could go up and do the show. And Brian Blessed was in reception at the BBC as well, and they were saying, oh, you know, sir, you need your pass before you go up. And he goes, a pass? I'm not Al-Qaeda, you know.
He's got a point.
He absolutely has a point.
His face is his passport.
No, his voice is his passport. Is what I'm
his
saying.
Face is his warrant.
Please verify him.
So yeah, Brian Blessed. But
what do we know about this version? Do we know the writer? Do we know what the source of it is? Is it origin story?
This is going to be at Fox. Okay. And so it seems that Disney, since they took over Fox, have been cleaning house a little bit. So this week it was officially confirmed. It had been rumored for a while that a production had been shut down on Wes Ball's Mouse Guard.
Yeah, and the production art came out, which looked amazing.
It did look amazing, actually.
What is Mouse Guard?
Mouse Guard is another graphic novel adaptation by a guy called David Peterson, and it's about a group of medieval military mice.
It's like, what? Have you ever read Brian Schack's books, Red Wall? things like that.
No.
Which, again, it's military mice.
No.
Okay.
There's a whole military
woodland
mice.
Woodland animals in general.
Okay. Apparently, who knows?
It's like Wind in the Willows, okay. but paramilitary.
You know, like Tom and Jerry with tanks, that kind of thing.
Gosh, so that's great.
So he had, it had been going at 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
He had cast it up, and it was the likes of Idris Elba and Andy Serkis and Thomas Brody Sangster, and really, really good cast. And it was written by Gary Whitta. And then news came in April that it was being shut down after the Disney takeover of Fox. So they thought, we're not sure about this one for various reasons. And this week yesterday it was confirmed by Wes Ball himself. He took to Twitter and said, yep, it's true. I'm gutted. I imagine that 2 months between it being shut down and yesterday's video was perhaps taken up with them trying to see whether they could get it going somewhere else.
Right.
And you think that, Netflix will make anything. So, why not? Why not? This is going to be played if I ever come to Netflix to pitch something. It's a really interesting pitch there, Mr. Hewitt, but could you explain this? Netflix will make anything. Netflix will make anything. Netflix will make anything. Deepfake. nothing to do with me. But they will.
Right.
So why wouldn't they do that?
But the feeling is that this project has kind of withered on the vine. It's got nowhere to go.
Too risky,
Yeah.
Okay. And it was like a mocap thing and,
Yeah.
So Idris Elba was going to play a cat in Cats and a mouse in Mouse Guard.
And a badger in the new Hobbs and Shaw film. True story.
Anyway, so we think that there was a live action, in fact, there's been talk of a live action Flash Gordon remake at...
Wasn't Matthew Vaughn making one at
Matthew
one point?
Vaughn was attached to it at one point, I believe. And so they now seem to be moving it towards animation for whatever reason. Perhaps they think it's too similar to Star Wars. And they don't want to ship
it. They're going 1930s instead of 1980s with this one, I think. So it's going back to its sort of comic roots.
Okay.
So we'll see. So I imagine high camp is not high on the agenda. But it could be fun. Could be interesting.
Yeah, he'll make it interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And of course, he's still got loads of stuff on his dance card. He's got the live-action Akira remake, which is, I think, scheduled for 2021. So even if, apparently his brief at the moment is just to try and crack it. So clearly they've been fiddling around with this thing and they haven't quite got it. And it's a tricky thing to get right, isn't it, Flash Gordon?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And obviously George was going to make it, wasn't he? That was his dream to make it but it was denied the rights, so he made Star Wars instead. Yeah, it'd be difficult. It'd be interesting to see how campy it gets, I think. You imagine it's got to have some kind of element of comedy and fun in it being him.
Yeah.
You can't imagine it be some kind of straight, kind of Ron Howard version of it.
Thor Ragnarok is essentially... Flash Gordon in a lot of ways, and for me, an improvement upon that.
Well, the first Thor was quite from an aesthetic point of view, heavily inspired by Gordon.
Yeah.
Did you see that Danny Boyle, while he's been in town, talking
love
about
it? I love a bit of Danny Boyle. It's great, actually. I love coming up with really great ideas for 28 months later, it's great. Zombies running around, brilliant. Love it, great.
I mean, that's
so weird. Danny Boyle just popped in here.
Yeah.
That's cool. Right, Danny.
Says something for
he's gone now.
Right.
So weird. I love leaving quickly. He's gone.
Yeah, so 28 months later. Apparently,
he's
got
impression.
A quote unquote properly good idea. He's been working up with Alex Garland for a third film, which I'm absolutely down for. Maybe it'd be 28 years later and it'd be zombies in post Brexit Britain.
Didn't I see that this was called, this was so. It's all dependent on Alex Garland's directorial slate and how that can happen. So,
or do they want him to direct it?
They want him to be
involved and he's busy.
But he's just busy, so I wouldn't hold your breath about this project.
But it's, I'd like to see that.
It has been a while since 28 weeks later.
I was on set of that.
Were you?
Yeah, true story.
See, you've just blown in out of the water with his...
I was on set of that because you were
room.
Too busy and couldn't do it.
Was
I? I remember this was offered to you and you were like, oh, I'll go. And I did.
Is that
really?
Fresnadillo director of that? Is that
Juan Carlos Fresnadillo?
Yeah.
Dio. Yeah. Yes, indeed it was. But yeah, it was good. It's good.
It's a good film. That
it's gory as all fucking hell.
Yeah,
it's brutal. But yeah, it is good.
Oh yeah, it's proper bleak.
Mm.
Doesn't take any prisoners.
28 Days Later has not aged well, and I don't mean as a film. I mean in the fact that it was shot on sort of I can't remember the name of them, little videotapes. And actually, there is no HD iteration that really works. Well, there is, but it's scaled up HD.
That's a shame.
Yeah,
that's
so it doesn't look as good as one might hope for a film that is that excellent.
Both good films, and I'd like to see a sequel. I don't know, 28 years later, as you say, maybe the infected are now the norms in society, and then maybe humans come into the and then they're the enemy in some way. I don't know, or some sort of Brexit analogy. Let's go with that, shall we? I'm excited about that, but I'd like Danny to elucidate a little bit more. I want to know what that properly good idea is, but he scarpered out of here before he could talk about it, which is a bit of a shame. Edgar Wright has added some cast members to Last Night in Soho.
Okay, who's that?
And you're going to like this.
Yeah.
He's added Diana Rigg.
Very good.
He's added Terrence Stamp.
Bloody hell.
He's added Rita Tushenham.
Wow.
I know.
So with his 60s kind of cool icons.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do we know about the plot of that film? Do we know anything?
We know nothing. We know very little. We know it's a psychological horror and it's set in Soho at night, I'm guessing. Right. We know it stars Anya Taylor-Joy, Thomasin McKenzie, and Matt Smith. And apart from that, we haven't pried too much. He was very, very kind to tell us, give us the first word on what that movie's going to be, psychological horror.
Yeah.
With a female lead,
but we think,
or leads.
But this is absolutely proper horror, isn't it? He's not adding a Shaun of the Dead element to it.
No, I don't think there's any.
This is kind of without the cackle and the glee. This is a scary movie.
Yeah, that's the hope.
Like his trailer for Don't.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's like one of those. Yeah.
That is the hope. The hope that this will actually nail the full trembling terror of what it is like to order from Nando's in Frith Street.
Exactly. Or to not get run over by a cyclist.
And then realise just too late as they disappear down the down the road that was Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Which has actually happened to me once. Some other bits of casting news. So Annette Bening is in talks to join the cast of Kenneth Branagh's Death on the Nile, which is exciting. That's a great cast already. Gal Gadot, Armie Hammer, Letitia Wright, and Jodie Comer. And, of course, Sir Ken as Hercule Poirot.
Did you like Murder on the Orient Express?
I was mixed on Murder on the Orient Express, if I'm honest, Ian. I liked a lot of things about it. I loved that tracking shot at the beginning as he kind of introduces all the characters.
Yeah,
I like Branagh when he really goes for it.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think he can be a little bit reserved as a filmmaker, a little bit traditional, a little bit classical. Maybe I sometimes think of Frankenstein put him off a little bit, all those grand sweeping flourishes.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
What do you think of his Poirot?
I there's so much talk about the moustache, wasn't there? I'm trying to remember. I thought it was okay. I didn't love it, remember.
Yeah.
I thought it looked beautiful as a film, but it kind of left me a bit cold, I think.
Okay. And I'm sure we're also excited about Red Sonja. Are we excited about Red Sonja?
This is James' wheelhouse, isn't it?
It's not, though. I don't have a lot of love for Red Sonja. I mean, this has been rattling around forever. But, I mean, the original Red Sonja film is, let's be honest, terrible.
Is it terrible?
It's pretty bad, yeah. And
I don't have
a huge affection for the graphic novels. I've never read any of the novelizations of it either. So I'm not huge on it. I was much more excited that King Conan might return, but that seems to have evaporated as well. But you know, I'm not writing this off at all.
Okay, so Red Sonja, is the Robert E. Howard creation. He's the guy who created Conan the Barbarian. Of course, there was a movie in 1985, I think, just after Conan the Destroyer. Starred Brigitte Nielsen as Red Sonja, who is a sword-wielding warrior. And there was a cameo in it from Arnold Schwarzenegger as well as Prince Kalidor, I believe.
As not Conan.
Not Conan, yes, because they didn't have the rights or something like that. So anyway, then it becomes a Conan thing and it all gets very, very complicated. So that was directed by Richard Fleischer. Wasn't very, very good. And they've been trying to make a remake or a different version of for a long, long time over at Millennium Films. And you may remember, recently, they hired Bryan Singer to direct this movie.
They did.
Orcs.
And that lasted about 5 minutes. And Bryan Singer exited left and people were up in arms about his appointment to that, and now they have a new director, a new writer-director. In fact, is Jill Soloway, who is the creator of Transparent, that hit show on Amazon.
Mm.
Do you watch it?
I have seen it, but I don't watch it regularly. No.
Okay,
but that's a very small-scale human comedy drama, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
So this feels like a big step up.
It does seem like a big step up, and Jill Soloway, they have directed just one movie before, which was Afternoon Delight, which was an independent movie, an indie movie, back in 2013.
Yes, but, I've seen that. It's good.
They said in a statement that they're looking forward to exploring this powerful mythology and evolving what it means to be a heroine. And, you know, I think this is very much in their wheelhouse and could be exciting. And there's, you know, here's the thing about, we've said this on the show constantly, that it seems to be that a lot of male directors can make an independent film and then make the leap immediately to
Star Wars Episode 8.
Yeah, precisely. It happens all the time. Yeah. So it is actually, I think, refreshing to see it happening with Jill Soloway, who clearly has a clear vision and a strong vision for Red Sonja. And I'm intrigued to see what they can do.
Tom Hardy is officially returning for Venom 2. Yes, Venom 2. So that's exciting.
It is exciting, isn't it?
This is my excited voice.
I remember reviewing that film and saying at the end of the review that it's kind of set itself up, that while the original had problems, it kind of set itself up well for a sequel.
Yeah.
So I don't think this is necessarily a bad idea.
I don't think it's a good movie, but I think we surprised ourselves by how much we enjoyed certain aspects of it.
I too am a loser, Eddie.
Yes. Except Brian Blessed again.
Yeah.
You know, because when they really go for with the comedy, when it's Tom Hardy sitting in a lobster tank trying to cool himself off or having conversations with himself, it's quite fun.
Yeah.
He just was in a different movie to everyone else.
Yeah.
And I would hope that this time everyone's going to be on the same page.
Yeah, well, they don't have to do all that establishing stuff, do they?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, so fingers crossed. And there has been some talk from within the MCU that there might be a Spider-Man Venom team up at some point. They might be making that happen, so we'll see how that works, but that's cool. And the last thing before we get into our second guest, did you see this thing here, Steve? You know, there's been rumors for a while that there'll be a Breaking Bad movie or a Breaking Bad spin-off. And did you see this thing here, Steve, that both Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul tweeted the same thing at the same time with the same message, and it was a picture of two donkeys, and the message was soon.
Okay, so what do we read into that?
They're making a film about two donkeys and it's coming out soon.
Yeah. Our old symbologist here.
What resonance does that have with the Breaking Bad world?
What is donkey on the periodic table? I don't know.
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe just, you know, they're two donkeys getting it back on the road, going to Blackpool. I don't know.
Two asses.
Two asses back. Yeah. It's not like even like Jesse and Walt had nicknames for each other. Also, spoiler alert for Breaking Bad here, people. And, you know, don't worry, the show ended 6 years ago, so if I'm pissing anyone's cornflakes, I apologize. But one of those characters is dead. So what are they going to do? So there has been talk of a spin-off that would be written and directed by Vince Gilligan, who's the creator of Breaking Bad, and that it would focus on Jesse Pinkman post-Breaking Bad. But Cranston, what would his involvement be? Flashbacks, dream sequence, maybe some, you know, I'm thinking of giving away that he's the one who's dead, but, you know, is there some way that they can get Walter White back?
It sounds hard, doesn't it? It sounds hard to shoehorn that in.
Either that or it's Madagascar 4, and this is Aaron Paul's way of saying he's joining the cast, but I don't know. I'm excited about it. If it happens, I'm all for it. I may even get to appear on your little podcast. What's it called? Friends with Friends? No, it's My Big TV.
Pilot TV.
Channel Hopping. Yes, oh, yeah, that's the one. That's the one. Yeah.
Pilot, no, we'd love to have you on, Chris.
Pilot TV podcast.
Yeah, we'll be doing a Blue Blood spoiler special soon.
Now you're talking.
You'll be invited on for that.
Now you are talking. Right, okay, that's it for the movie news. Time now for our second guest, and he is the star of this week's Yesterday. You heard just a few minutes ago from the film's director, Danny Boyle, and this is a rather lovely film, spoiler for the review section, about a man who is a musician who is knocked out, enters a coma at the exact same moment that the world suffers a mysterious and unexplained blackout. When he awakens, when Jack, the character in question, awakens, he finds that he can remember who the Beatles were, but mysteriously, somehow, no one else can. So he uses this, because he's a musician, to play the music of the Beatles, and that catapults him to stardom and international fame. So it's written by Richard Curtis, directed by Danny Boyle, and provides a great starring vehicle for Himesh Patel, who EastEnders fans may remember. He was on the show for 9 years, but this is a lovely big break on the big screen, and he's very, very good indeed in the film, so I was very, very excited to talk to him. And turns out we had, interestingly, a connection in the past. A connection in the past.
Ooh.
And that's where we begin this interview. So here's me talking to Himesh Patel. Enjoy. Delighted to be joined in the Empire Podcast by the star of Yesterday, Himesh Patel. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thank you.
You have a story for me. First thing you said to me when you came in, you have a story.
It's about podcasts as well.
Okay, yep.
So this was probably, what, about 6 years ago now? Trance was coming out. And at a very well-known fruit-based retailer, they do these Q&As. at their stores.
Yep, yep.
And I believe you mm-hmm. did one with Danny Boyle. And at the end, you opened it out to the audience. And I put my hand up and I asked Danny Boyle, what does he look for in his actors?
You're kidding me.
And here we are today.
That's amazing. Mm. And the thing is, we can check this.
You can check it because it's still online.
It was filmed. It was recorded. That's incredible.
Yeah. So thanks for letting me ask the question, because maybe it was the beginning of good luck.
I remember that because he took your number and your card.
He took my number. Ah, yeah. No, it was just a complete transaction. And I paid you beforehand, didn't
I? That's right. Yes. Yeah. So thank you for that. Usual 10%?
Yeah.
Usual 10%.
Absolutely.
That's incredible. So is that the sort of thing, did you go to those Q&As often?
I did, actually, yeah, for a little while. I don't know how often they do those anymore.
Do them anymore. But, Meet the Filmmaker. Oh, yeah. I might as well promote another podcast.
Yeah. While I'm here. It doesn't exist. Might as well promote it. I went to a few, actually.
Is that because, you know, of a wider interest in films and filmmaking?
Yeah, no, definitely.
Okay.
So it's nice to be on the Empire podcast, actually. Yeah.
Oh, well, it's a delight to have you here. I love the film. So did you mention this to Danny at any point in your interactions with
movies? Yeah, recently.
Okay.
I was very nervous. I mentioned it to him at all because he'd kind of go, I don't want him to get freaked out, you know. But I think it's been long enough now. The film's in the can. He knows I'm not a stalker. I told him. Yeah.
That's what did he say?
Yeah, he was clearly very touched about that, yeah. It's a very strange thing. It's a very strange thing.
I'll tell you what, you know, from my point of view, doing those Q&As, and I still do Q&As as well, whenever people... I'm available to do Q&As, by the way. I'm just throwing it out there. It's a bit of a minefield, as I'm sure you know, when you're pointing at people.
Sure.
Because, you know, you just don't know when you're going to hit the, I have a script, I have a gift, this isn't a question, it's a comment in 47 parts.
Yeah.
So thank you for actually just getting to the point. And
it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, I always, I start to tense up a bit when I do I do Q&As with mm-hmm. this film. I've done a couple, and when you go to them, and you just kind of go, I hope this is a question. And I really hope this is not like, you know, just a kind of, I'm going to analyze the film for you here.
Yeah.
And what I loved was.
Yeah.
And then they just leave it at that. And it's like, okay, cool. I guess that wasn't really a question.
I guess this side of the Q&A is not new for you, but you had 9 years on EastEnders.
Yeah.
And I imagine your interactions with the press were fairly different. I mean, these junkets are regimented, you're flown around the world, you're stuck in a hotel room with idiots like me who ask the same questions over and over again. And that's like a 2 week burst, and then it's done.
Yeah, so this is like the beginning of a 2 week burst really for me. And we've done a few days before, but it is very different. It's completely different. And especially when I was on EastEnders, really, my press interaction was minimal anyway. Generally, I just wasn't that interested in it. But also, I was vaguely aware that when you're on a show like that, if you attach yourself too much to it, then it'll be hard to kind of let that go in a way. You kind of have to be very careful as to how you remind people that you're on it, you know, because otherwise, historically, people haven't allowed people to kind of move past it. It's changing now.
Mm.
You know, I feel very lucky to be doing all this right now. And my friend Ben Hardy's done very well since he left EastEnders.
Absolutely.
So, and there's other people as well doing some great work post soap, as it were. So, it's changing, but this whole thing is very different to anything that we would experience on that.
How do you prepare for it? What prepares you for it?
I talking to people, you know, doing a film like this, obviously I had Danny around, I had Richard, Lily, who was invaluable in kind of like, you know, how does this all work kind of thing. But of course, ultimately, when it comes to all this crazy stuff that we get to do, which is, you know, at times really amazing and fun, you got to kind of keep the people you love close to you, really. The people who matter to you the most are the ones who will keep you sane, which in a way is kind of the story we tell in Yesterday, is that, you know, he gets all this fame and this success, but he runs away from the most important person in his life.
Yeah.
And that is kind of what's destroying him.
It's a guy who gets very much overwhelmed, and not just overwhelmed by fame and a notion of fame as well, but, you know, Jack is overwhelmed by the idea that he doesn't deserve it, and he's built his fame, he's built his mountain, he's built his molehill almost on someone else's mountain.
Yes, in a
weird way.
Yeah.
And Brandon, there's a lot of imposter syndrome going on with
definitely it. It's very much about imposter syndrome kind of writ large, really.
That was the working title for the film initially.
Yeah.
They thought Yesterday would be better. Yeah. The Beatles didn't do a song called Imposter Syndrome.
No, Imposter Syndrome writ large. No, that wasn't... it was not quite pithy enough. It's something that I've thought about, Imposter Syndrome, every now and then. Because, I never trained as an actor. I was on EastEnders from the age of 16, so I was kind of a bit like, I just fell into it. I don't know what I'm doing. But, you learn as you go, and I've been very lucky to work with some amazing actors whilst I was on EastEnders and since.
Yeah.
And it's all just learning from these people. And in that way, you improve.
There are different ways into everything. It's like, even stuff like Empire, you ask everybody in the office how you got into this business. Mm. No two stories are the same. And I'm sure it was the same on EastEnders, and I'm sure it was the same on Yesterday. Yesterday, I found out, for example, I saw a thing with Helen Mirren on YouTube that she didn't train either. She didn't go to acting college. She just kind of started as well. So it's kind of just one of those interesting things. And I can't imagine there's probably better on-the-job training than the grind of EastEnders.
There's a lot of scenes per day and a lot of last-minute rewrites and a lot of, you have to work fast. If there is something with a scene that's sticking, and you want to get it solved, you kind of have to figure it out. And so that leads to collaboration, which is very much Danny's philosophy as well. He's a very collaborative filmmaker. I'm sure you've spoken to him over the years, but he talks about his films as like, we made a film, we did this. He talks about it collectively, and that shows in the way that he directs. He's very collaborative and appreciative of the people around him who are making this thing happen.
So conversation at the Apple Store aside, with Danny Boyle, what was your first conversation with him for this?
So I met him at my first audition, my first proper audition. I met him and Richard, and we had a nice audition, and then I had another audition with Danny, and then I was waiting, and then I got a call from Danny saying, I'd love you to play the part, and I literally that night I got a call from him, and I wasn't feeling well anyway, and I wound up in A&E because I was I was ill, and then it just got progressively worse after I got the call, and then my girlfriend wound up taking me to, she called 111, we'd just been on holiday with some friends, and the lady on the other end of the line was like, have you been away recently? My girlfriend was like, yeah. She's like, where did you go? She went, Lanzarote. Oh, that sounds nice. Meanwhile, I'm sweating and writhing on the bed, what's happening to me? And then eventually she was like, you should probably take him to A&E. So we went to A&E, and there was nothing wrong with me. Absolutely nothing wrong with me. The nurse was like, I don't know what's going on with him. He's sweating. I'd taken night nurse, to try and get sleep, so I was drowsy anyway.
Yeah.
But she was like, I don't know what's wrong with this guy. He's absolutely fine.
I can't
He's
die.
Just got a cold.
I've just got the lead in the new Danny Boyle.
Exactly. But I think that was maybe what it was, a shock that kind of sent me spiraling.
That sounds right. Yeah, that sounds good.
So the first time I spoke to Danny Boyle after he offered me the role, I ended up in A&E, is what I'm saying to you. but yeah, not long after that disastrous thing, the first time I had a proper meeting with him about the movie was me, Danny, and Daniel Pemberton, our composer. Yeah. And we went to Daniel's flat. And, Daniel's got this amazing flat with instruments everywhere. So Danny had a list of the songs for the movie, and basically we just had to figure out what it was that I was going to be comfortable playing straight off the bat, what needed work, and we realised that they all needed work. And so we got to it, and we realised, which songs are the songs that we need, the most important, set-piece songs in the movie and that kind of thing. And we got to work. I had about 2 months to prepare for it.
So what was your skill level beforehand, and what's your skill level now?
Skill level now is a lot better than it was beforehand. I'm still not any sort of virtuoso. I can't do a solo. Don't think I could do a solo. But
John Lennon wasn't a great guitar player.
He was by eventually, though, wasn't he? I mean, he did have the privilege of hanging out with three other great musicians. So who better to learn from? But, I'm a lot better now than I was. And I'd played piano between the ages of 9 and 12 and then given that up to try and teach myself guitar. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have the privilege of hanging out with any sort of virtuoso musicians who were going to teach me anything, so it wasn't that good. But I got a lot better in the 2 months that I was learning. I had people helping me. I had Daniel, his friend Ade Milhan, who's a brilliant musician who did the score for In the Loop, which is a brilliant movie. So we hung out 2 months in this room that we made to look like Jack's bedroom. And I just kind of just, we created our own versions of the songs, because of course they don't exist, so that we couldn't be beholden and slavish to the originals, but we had to respectfully create our own versions of them. And it was just like the most fun prep period I'll ever have, I think.
It's a really crazy notion. We're doing a spoiler podcast special with Danny and Richard. Yeah. Later on, we get into the nitty gritty and, you know, various twists and turns in the movie. Yeah. But it's such a crazy notion. And, you know, Jack in the movie obviously has to rely upon this knowledge of the Beatles. And sometimes that can be a little bit wonky, I guess. You know, that's why maybe some, you know, the lyrics aren't quite there in some songs. But is there an artist that, say, for example, the same thing happened overnight? You talked to Danny Boyle again. You got a bit sweaty. You went to A&E. You blacked out. The world blacked out at the same time. You woke up and the world had forgotten the artist you love more than anyone, which is?
Top of my head, Arctic Monkeys.
Arctic Monkeys. All right. And you had to recreate the Arctic Monkeys songs from scratch. How well would you do?
I'm not from Sheffield, so I'd do terribly. I'd just be doing a really bad Alex Turner impression, you know. Because that's what's amazing about Alex Turner is I think he's, you know, he's an original.
Yeah.
He's an original. So I don't think you could. Then you could say the same things about the Beatles, but the Beatles have seeped into our national and international consciousness to such a degree.
Yeah.
That it seems a little more plausible. You just, I don't know, imagine if you could do, like, you know, the Arctic Monkeys version of this movie.
That's the thing about this. It's such a great idea. You could do it for anything. Literally anything.
I think we started the new Marvel
universe. I think you have. Yeah, it's the Forgetful Cinematic Universe.
The FCU.
Yeah, great. The FCU. That's nice. Maybe not the greatest acronym, but we'll come up with something else.
Yeah.
It'll be totally fine. So Arctic Monkeys, that's interesting. See, yeah. I don't, you know, those lyrics, immediately off the top of my head, is like... And I only really know the first album really well.
Okay, yeah.
But you can. And I'd be struggling.
Really?
Not just the lyrics, but the chord progressions? I mean, how the hell do you...
Yeah, they're not... It's no. Yeah, but the lyrics are the... You know, lyrics are so important to me and the music that I love. I was an indie kid, you know, growing up, so it was, you know, Arctic Monkeys and Franz Ferdinand and all these amazing bands. Okay, Maximo Park. Mm. But yeah, the Arctic Monkeys were obviously top of the pile there. Mm. And his lyricism was just... The thing that, especially that third album, you know, the first two albums were incredible. Mm. And that third album, he just went off on one. And a lot of people didn't like that. But I thought his lyrics just were incredible in that third record.
But am I right in thinking that when you got this gig, that you weren't a huge Beatles connoisseur?
No, yeah, I wasn't. It kind of been drip fed into my life really up until that point. My mum's favourite song is Imagine. And so that was kind of one thing that's kind of offshoot of the Beatles kind of thing. Mm-hmm. The first song I remember hearing was I saw her standing there at school when I was about 10. We were doing like this thing about the 60s and I think they played that.
Which is a fairly big song in the film as well. It gets played a couple of times.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Also, despite the slightly dodgy lyrics.
Slightly questionable lyric, yeah. I did bring that up on set, but nothing came of it. and so it's something that kind of... And then Sgt. Pepper's when I was in my teens... The White Album, because I had an iPod that I gave my friend to put music on, Gabriel. Mm. I've not seen him in about 10 years.
Gabriel, but if you're listening, get in touch.
Gabriel, thank you very much. Mm. But he put some Beatles on that iPod, and the White Album, I believe, was on there, and bits of Abbey Road. Mm. And obviously, of course, the songs that we all know, the albumless songs like Hey Jude and that kind of thing. Doing this, though, meant that I had to start at the beginning and go all the way through, and it was... Just the best research I'll probably ever do for a role.
What if you'd hated it? What if you were a real Beatles skeptic?
That would have been awkward. Yeah.
You were just like, this is just, I can't do this. What if your favourite stuff was Ringo stuff?
Yeah, I know. Although, I mean, there are some nice Ringo songs.
I'll listen.
Octopus's Garden.
I would go to bat for Ringo all day long. Banger after banger.
Yeah.
With the possible exception of... Don't Pass Me By from the White Album, but we'll maybe get at it another day. But there's a lot to say about that song. But you filmed a lot of this in Liverpool as well.
Yeah,
I'm also a Liverpool fan, so I appreciated the Mo Salah name check as well. I don't know if that was
an
ad-lib on your part,
or was
that a Richard line?
That was a bit of ADR, I think it might have been, actually.
Really?
Or maybe it was on the day.
I'm pretty sure we see you say it, so it's...
You know, so it was on the day?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's going to be really awkward. I'm going to admit that I'm a Spurs fan.
Okay.
Congratulations.
Well, it's been fun.
So is Richard.
It's been fun having you on the podcast, and I wish you all the best. No, there's no animosity here. It's all. No, it might have been had the result gone the other way, but, you know,
Totally fine.
No, my wife used to work for Spurs.
Oh, right.
Yeah, she once gave André Villas-Boas a lift to the train station in our car.
He got the train.
Yeah, he was going to Stansted. Oh, so he needed a lift to the train station. So she was volunteered to give him a lift in our car because we had just got it cleaned.
That was the last time anyone saw Andre Villas-Boas.
Yeah. But anyway, there was a Mo Salah name check, which is good, and especially from a Spurs fan, that must have been very painful for you. You're filming up there in Liverpool, and I think the Beatles are fairly popular up there.
People know who they are up there, yeah.
they're aware of them.
They're aware of them, yeah.
How aware were they of your film? I mean, I guess the way Danny shoots is he probably shoots very, very quickly, very, very light as well.
Yeah.
So are you in and out before anyone's realised,
he does... When we were shooting on Penny Lane,
yeah,
we did like this tracking shot, and then we finished that, and then we was like, we're going to go to the next setup, and we had like a few minutes to just kind of chill out, and I was just chatting to Richard and Joel Fry, who was there, and then I looked up, and there was just this massive crane that was like a lot of feet in the air. I was like, where did that come from? And he's done this amazing shot, aerial shot of Penny Lane. So I think Liverpool was probably aware of it at that point. But they were generally, aware. There was, a bit of press around who kind of got some shots and stuff.
Yeah.
But they, they were so welcoming and brilliant. And we all went to the Cavern Club one night. And,
wow.
And, went for a night out there. And I really fell in love with Liverpool. I think it's a really lovely, lovely city. We just went back there for international press a couple of weeks ago. And it's just something about it. Whether it's just next to such an, vast expanse of water or something, I don't know, but it's got something about it, the way the culture is there. It feels like it's very inclusive. It feels like it's very international in a way.
Yeah,
I don't know whether
that's
because of the Beatles, but it feels different to a lot of other places in the UK that I've been to anyway.
Possibly. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, they have the Beatles, they have two major football clubs, Liverpool and Liverpool under-23s.
Yes.
And so they have people coming in from all over the world, so perhaps there's more of a feeling of inclusivity. I know that the city's been re-energized an awful lot by EU money, so they're very, very open to that as well.
Absolutely,
so maybe there's something going on there also. Yeah. But what about yourself? What's next for you? What's
coming out next? I've got The Aeronauts with Eddie Redmayne and Felicity Jones, which I started filming that about a year ago now.
Are you finished? Are you
I'm all done. Yeah, they're obviously still tinkering with it though, because there's a lot of effects that need to go into it. But I cannot wait to see it because, the bits that really require it, I wasn't really involved in. So I can't wait to see what they did with all that. And it'll be out in IMAX, which is really exciting.
That's good.
And I've got a TV series for BBC Two called The Luminaries, which took me to New Zealand for 5 months. So I was living there, and it was an amazing time. And it's a really thrilling story. It's very unusual, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that turns out as well. So.
Fantastic. Are you still dabbling in the guitar? Are you playing every day?
Still, but trying to keep it up. Yeah, trying to keep it up as much as I can. And of course, it kind of gets pulled out a little bit during this during this press tour, so it kind of keeps me sharp.
I notice you have a guitar right here, right now. You brought one with you.
Here we
drum
go.
Kit.
Yeah.
Let's do the show right here. One day they may bring the Apple Store Q&As back, and
we
may sit down.
With Danny, that would be nice.
With Danny.
Yeah.
And someone in the front row might ask you a question, and 6 years later you'll be working with them, and that's how movie making works.
It's crazy, isn't it? You never know.
You never know. Himesh Patel, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Cheers, dude.
So that was Himesh Patel, and if you want to listen to that Meet the Filmmakers Q&A with Danny Boyle from a few years ago for Trance, I'm going to try and find it and tweet out the link, and you can actually hear the moment where Himesh Patel was in the audience and asked Danny Boyle a question.
Oh,
and
cool.
That was their first interaction. And then, I don't ask for much, Ian.
No.
I just ask for recognition. Some sort of financial compensation would be nice.
Yeah.
I brokered that meeting.
Absolutely.
I think I'm just a cool mill, I think, is all I'm asking for. But that was lovely. It was really, really nice.
Yeah.
Really
nice hearing special that. Thanks in the credits, at the end of the film.
Yeah.
A dedication, perhaps, at the beginning for Chris Hewitt.
For Chris Hewitt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or just the film, instead of being called Yesterday, could be called Chris Hewitt.
Yeah.
Or just Hewitt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wakes up after a coma and he realises that everyone's forgotten everything but me. And I've become some sort of living god.
Fucking nightmare, isn't it?
That's my life.
Anyway, it was a pleasure talking to Himesh. And now, should we start talking about some movie reviews? Before we get on to talk about Yesterday, let's talk about Spider-Man Far From Home, which is out on Tuesday, July 2nd.
both here and in the States. And in case you're wondering, yes, there will be a spoiler special podcast for this movie with the director, John Watts, with the producer, Kevin Feige, and with the another producer, Amy Pascal. And that's going to be going up mid-July, around July 13th, 14th, 15th, something like that. So keep an eye out for that. But the movie itself, this is the second full-blown movie to feature Spider-Man in the MCU. Ian, as you know, his fifth appearance in the MCU.
Of course, obviously.
Falling off your tongue, the other appearances.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm going to come to you first as not an MCU skeptic or agnostic, but maybe someone who, you know, just doesn't connect to these movies.
Absolutely. And I like these movies. I just think they're fun teen movies with some superhero nonsense grafted on top.
Yep.
I think Tom Holland's really charming. Zendaya's great. They're funny and light. For me, I didn't think this one worked as well as Homecoming. For one thing, it doesn't have that anything like that kind of vulture reveal when Michael Keaton opens the door and he's standing there. There's anything like that. But I just think it's charming. I do. I think, you know, the effect sequences, for me, get a bit samey, but I thought for a lot of its runtime, I thought it was fun.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it's quite on a level with Homecoming. I don't think there's an awful lot in it. I enjoyed this enormously, and I think this film had a lot on its plate, a lot of heavy lifting to do, because it comes directly after Endgame and represents a serious tonal shift from that film, but also has a lot of, you know, narrative heavy lifting to do, because it has to deal with the aftermath of that film, and it's a masterstroke.
Yeah, how it does that, and you'll talk about that on your spoiler special, is terrific. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible.
Then the plot sends them on a vacation.
And it all goes a bit Euro trip.
To Euro,
but in a good way. Yeah. In a good way. And as you say, the characters are all incredibly charming. They're such fun to be around. It's a really light touch on the script. It's really funny. It's really pacey.
Yeah.
I loved it. I always, quote unquote, marvel at how they manage to do this with quite difficult things. So everyone had an idea of what this film was going in, I think, from looking at the trailer. But I think it still manages to surprise, and that's impressive.
All I will say is, stick around for the end.
Yes, very much stick around for both the credits.
I mean, you
know
that. You know that already going into a Marvel movie, but stick around for the end.
Yeah.
We're 23 films in now to the franchise. And so, in Bond terms, we are now on Skyfall. In carry-on terms, Ian, where would we be, roughly?
Oh, are we on carry-on girls, maybe?
We're getting into the dregs now, aren't we? We're
nearly Emmanuel.
No. We're past camping.
Yeah, we're past about England.
We're past Doctor again.
Yeah.
I don't know. we're in the bad stuff.
We are,
The bad times are happening.
Yeah.
And the bad times are not happening in the MCU, guys. I'm delighted to report. I'm also with Ian and James on this one a little bit. I didn't think it was quite as successful as Homecoming, which felt a lot like a breath of fresh air and had something, a new tone for the MCU. But I had an absolute blast with it. And it echoes a little bit my feelings on Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 as well, in that I could spend a long time with these characters. They are delightful to spend time with when they are being themselves. Mm.
So this one has a good story as well, so that's useful.
Yes, it does. It does. You mean Guardians of...
I mean, unlike Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, I see. You were dissing Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Very, very clever.
Tom Holland, I'm saying best Spider-Man ever. I think he's fantastic.
Think Nicholas Hammond will fight you? Yeah. No,
I'm going for Nicholas Hammond. Come on.
No, I think that's fair. That is fair. He's great. He's the best Peter Parker as well.
Yeah, but that's why this is a Peter Parker works. Movie. And I think this is why this works, because I think Spider-Man is best when it's a Peter Parker movie, because Peter Parker embodies everything that Spider-Man is. I think that personality is so much a part of that character. And they really nail that in these films, which I think they haven't done previously.
I'm not saying that the bits of Spider-Man get a little passé, but, you know, when Spider-Man suits up, it's not that I lose interest, but I prefer the moments when it's Peter Parker, it's sippy repartee with Zendaya as MJ, or with Jacob Batalon as Ned, or in this case, you know, whether it's even Tony Revolori as Flash Thompson. And in this movie, he gets new people to banter with.
Yeah.
So he gets Jake Gyllenhaal as Quentin Beck, a.k.a. Mysterio, bloke with a fishbowl on his head. He gets Nick Fury, Sam Jackson's Nick Fury, and their relationship is different. There's Happy Hogan in there, there's Aunt May, there's loads of stuff for him to bounce off and be constantly wrong-footed by. And, you know, it's basically a movie about a hormonal teenager who's trying to fall in love with a girl and trying to make it happen, and all this other shit happens to him while he's trying to have a break. And the last time we saw a beloved character go to Europe on a vacation was A Good Day to Die Hard. And this is not that, thank God.
No,
it's not on a level with A Good Day to Die Hard. No, nothing can be.
Is it Deuce Bigalow European Gigolo? No.
No.
It's not quite that good, but I had an absolute blast with it, and I think we gave it 4 stars.
We did.
We gave it 4 stars. Four English stars.
Our very own Peter Parker.
Ben Travis. He is in so many ways, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
He's never around when Travis Man is around. Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah, exactly. I've noticed that.
What's going on with that? So yes, 4 stars then for Spider-Man Far From Home, and keep them peeled for the spoiler special on that one as well. That's Talk Yesterday, but that's Talk Yesterday right now. Jimbo, now talk about Ian being an MCU skeptic or an MCU agnostic. You are a Beatles skeptic. You're a Beatles agnostic. You may even be a Beatles hater.
I wouldn't say I'm a hater, but I think their charms are largely lost on me, idiot that I am. I'm absolutely prepared to admit that I'm on the wrong side of this argument, but I've tried to love them and I can't. That said, I am a long-time Richard Curtis apologist. So I think between the two of us, Chris, we had this film nailed. No, I mean, you've already gone through the plot on this one, but I really enjoyed this. I think your worry in this going in for people who don't love the Beatles is this: the single premise behind this film is that the Beatles is the greatest band that ever was, and their songs are the greatest songs ever written. Like, that's the premise underlying this film, and you kind of have to roll with that to get the film. And even though I'm not such a big fan of them, I was absolutely fine with that as a premise, and I totally got it, and I really enjoyed this story that the transcendent power of this songwriting kind of is the greatest legacy, the musical legacy that the world has ever seen, and that anyone can play these songs and become the biggest star in the world. And I found this really touching. I thought Himesh Patel was fantastic in the lead. I really enjoyed Lily James in this as well. This is kind of roadie / will they, won't they love interest type person.
Have a wild guess.
And it's really, I mean, this is everything you want from Richard Curtis though, isn't it? You know, like it's soppy, it's sentimental, it's warm and fuzzy. You go out feeling a bit like, oh, you know, I loved it. And for the exact same reason, I think a lot of people who maybe are not as fond of Curtis's charms will push back against this, because this has polarized people. Uh-huh. Like when we came out the screening, like you and I both loved it, and a lot of people came out and wanted to kill it with fire.
Did they?
Yes, they did.
Which people?
A number of Empire writers accosted me after I tweeted that I liked it.
Who?
And said I was mad. Jolin was one of them.
No, he's not allowed opinions on movies since he gave Independence Day Resurgence and Suicide Squad 4 stars in the same year, so no.
Someone I know from the BBC also DM'd me on Twitter to say I was a lunatic and that it was a hate crime of a movie, which I think is incredibly harsh.
I really liked it.
Yeah, exactly. I loved it too. Loads of fun.
One thing I really like about it that you don't get a sense of in the trailers is that it's not just the Beatles who disappear from the world.
Yes.
Other things disappear. And that's very funny.
Yes, lots of funny things.
Lots of good funny stuff in that.
That's mind for humour. I mean, Ed Sheeran can be a bit of a pop culture hate figure, certainly post Game of Thrones. And him being in this, I know a lot of people are like, oh God, I thought he was really good in this.
Good.
He sends himself up, he makes himself the butt of the jokes and does it really well. He's a really good sport. And some of the best lines, I think, in this actually revolve around his involvement. So I thought he was great as well.
I'm with you on this one as well. I went into this very sceptical about it. Huge Beatles fan. And I wasn't sure how this was going to play. Also, I wasn't sure how the Danny Boyle-Richard Curtis combination was going to play either, because Richard Curtis, as you say, is known for the warm and the fuzzies, and Danny Boyle isn't, necessarily. It's not to say he's incapable of it. You know, he's made some lovely, lovely films in the past.
Yeah. They all have edge.
Sunshine. 28 Days Later.
A lovely train spot.
Yeah, but he has made films like Millions as well.
Yeah,
and Slumdog Millionaire has his lovely dark moments as well, but lovely moments also. I wasn't sure how they would work together, and it seems actually that Danny Boyle's propensity for the offbeat and the offbeat camera angle and maybe his lack of sentimentality has worked pretty nicely here and created a lovely central relationship between Himesh Patel as Jack and Lily James as Ellie. It is a lovely relationship. It feels real. It feels lived in as well, and it has this aching longing going on there as well. She's great. She's as good as I've seen her on the big screen, actually, in this. Lily James, she's absolutely fantastic. And he's great as well. Himesh Patel is fantastic. And how great and how refreshing as well that we have a lead role in a movie like this that is played by a South Asian actor or an actor of colour, and nothing is made of their ethnicity at all. And that is refreshing and hopefully a step in the right direction. But as a Beatles fan, I was worried about it for a number of reasons, and I think the whole thing is handled sensitively. Yes, the idea is not taken to its logical conclusion, because if you took the Beatles out of the 1960s, then a lot of stuff changes. There's a joke early on in the film about, you know, when Jack first wakes up and he starts playing Yesterday on his guitar, and his friends are amazed by it, and he calls it the greatest song ever written. And they go, it's good, but it's no Fix You by Coldplay. And you go, I'm going, you know, if you took this to its logical extension, no Beatles means no Coldplay. No Beatles means no Ed Sheeran. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's, you know, yeah. And there's a lot of knock-on effects from having no Beatles. So I'm glad it hasn't gone into that, because you become maybe a dark dystopia. You know, you'd emerge into a sort of post-apocalyptic landscape. Who knows?
And the music sequences, I thought, are really enjoyable. Yes. Weirdly, I wanted more of that. For someone who's not a big Beatles fan, I very much enjoyed the performance of the Beatles numbers, so much so that I may or may not have busted out a Beatles album the day after and actually listened to some Beatles.
This is big stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it didn't last. I did it for like an hour.
which Beatles album?
Yeah, it was actually the awful. Literally, it was, you know that album, The One, which is all the number one hits? It was that one.
But that's good. So, yeah. That's fine. Yeah. Because one of the central theses of this film is that these songs are strong enough to make a cultural impact no matter who sings them and no matter what point in time. And I'm not sure that entirely works for me. The songs are amazing. They're incredible, incredible songs. But there's something about that perfect storm of the Beatles at the time when they came up in the 1960s, the personality of the boys, their voices, their guitar skills, their drumming skills, everything. Just a perfect storm of everything that happened that made them the phenomenon that they were. And also the fact that back then, you know, there wasn't a lot of options for people entertainment-wise.
Yeah.
There weren't hundreds of channels. There wasn't YouTube. There wasn't video games, all this sort of stuff. So it was either Beatles or bust. You know what I mean? Yeah. and that helped as well.
Just saying, if they'd had Netflix, the Beatles just would have
I'm died. Saying that. That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, there's an old phrase, it's the singer, not the song. And this movie's saying it's the song, not the singer. And I think that's interesting. And it's fairly well explored. There's some interesting diversions in this film that surprised me.
Yeah, I also thought that it absolutely benefits from Danny Boyle directing it rather than Richard Curtis, who, for example, the moment the world gets knocked out in going into blackout, that's proper filmmaking. That that I don't think Curtis, good filmmaker though he is, I'm not sure he would have got there. He'd done something different with it. And just the musical sequences have Boyle's hand in it in a way that perhaps Curtis wouldn't have delivered.
I enjoy the relatability of the fact, like when he's trying to remember the lyrics to Eleanor Rigby and just sort of freewheeling. What is it? What is a priest and a darning socks and something? Like, that's funny. Because realistically, a few people will know every lyric to every Beatles song off by heart. So,
I wonder if Kate McKinnon, who kind of plays his manager, is in a different film.
A little bit. She's a bit standard character, isn't she, really? Yeah. A little bit stereotypical, which is a bit of a shame. Yeah. She is, she's in a very, very different film, especially as it goes on and he gets a little bit bigger. But I really liked it. And we gave this 4 stars.
Yep.
We did.
And hey, we're going to be doing a spoiler special on this movie as well with the film's writer, Richard Curtis, and the film's director, Danny Boyle. And you may be saying to yourself, but Chris, this is just a standard rom-com with a bit of lovely music thrown in. Why on earth would you do a spoiler special? Watch the movie and then you'll know. Right, let's move on now to talk about In Fabric, which is the new movie from Peter Strickland. I'm the only person in the room who's seen it. Am I right?
Yes, you are
in thinking that? Okay, so I'm going to talk about this one very, very quickly, but it is essentially about a haunted dress. It is a deeply, deeply weird film that seems very, very inspired by Dario Argento's Suspiria, although I read an interview with Peter Strickland. I haven't yet heard the one he did on our show, so he may have said the same thing. But he said that actually that wasn't a conscious influence on this movie, which is weird because it's all there.
He's been talking about The Office as an influence.
He's been talking about The Office. He's been talking about all sorts of other stuff as well, but not Suspiria. And I wonder if he's maybe deliberately throwing people off the scent here, because this is a better remake of Suspiria than the remake of Suspiria.
So what is the setup? It's a haunted department. It's like, it's Debenhams with ghosts, isn't it, or something?
Yeah, it's like, are you being served only with witches, essentially? I'm on board already. Yeah. It's a really interesting audio-visual, oral experience, this movie. The soundtrack is really dense and layered, as you probably might expect from Peter Strickland. It revolves around Sheila, who is a bank worker played by Marianne Jean-Baptiste. A lot of people have said it's her best role since Secrets and Lies.
But good to see her in anything. You never
great
see
to see her in anything.
Yeah.
But I say those people have not watched Without a Trace.
Yes, of course. Yeah, I knew you were going to say that.
7 seasons of Without a Trace before it disappeared Without a Trace. And she was solid in that show. So good stuff. Opposite, of course, Anthony DePaglia as FBI agent Jack Malone. Anyway, so She is Sheila. She's a bank employee, and she is now single. Her husband has left her. She has a grown-up son whose girlfriend, played by Gwendolyn Christie, is quite frankly horrible to her. And she's a bit lost in life. She has two very weird bosses, played by Steve Oram and Julian Barrett as well, who give her these weird condescending lectures every now and again. Very, very funny. And she's a bit lost. And so she buys a red dress in a sale from this freaky department store. And it turns out to have a malevolent presence that affects her life and the lives of others.
Is that
as
like
well.
One of the labels that's really scratchy, but then when you cut it out, it's yes. even scratchier?
Even scratchier yeah. and leaves a rash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's just pretty like that. Much
but
exactly what happens.
By reputation, it's Strickland's funniest film.
It's very, very, very funny.
So however malevolent it is, it's funny.
It's being yeah. sold as a horror movie, but I thought it was hilarious. And there are moments, I don't want to give anything away, but pretty much every Julian Barrett, Steve Oram appearance is great. Fatma Muhammad is brilliant as Miss Luckmore, who is a sinister sales assistant in this department store, okay. who has the most convoluted sales speak you will ever hear. She's essentially an evil string-pulling witch who just happens to deal in high fashion. Yeah. She's brilliant in this.
Okay.
Marion Jean-Baptiste is great. I'm going to give a shout out to Leo Bill as well as Reg Speaks, who's a character who becomes prominent throughout the film. And there's an incredible running gag with him, which is, I think, made me laugh as long as anything I've seen this year. So it's got this wonderful mood to it. It's the reason I said the Fabrizi Strangler is because it reminded me of the Greasy Stranglers from the same production company, Rook Films. And it's got this weird off-kilter, out-there sensibility. It's not quite as kitschy as or trashy as The Greasy Strangler.
Right.
But it's certain, and it's in a completely different key, but it reminded me of that same very right. deliberately weird, deliberately surreal movie. And yeah, I had a lot of fun with this one. I think we gave this 4 stars.
4 stars, John Nugent.
We gave this 4 stars. So good having you here, and you keep me abreast of all the star ratings. So it's a 4-star week. It's a 4-star week.
Is it a sense that it's some kind of metaphor for consumerism, or is it not as heavy-handed as that?
No, there is that as well. Yeah. There is that as well. And you know, you have scenes, for example, of the ladies in the department store beckoning the shoppers to them and getting them, you know, worked up into a frenzy, and the shoppers are at the door banging on the glass and they yeah. can't wait because they define
That's
themselves
Romero,
by what they buy.
It?
A little bit of Romero in there yeah. as well. But ultimately, it's just, I think it's just his own weird mood poem.
Bro.
But I thought it was great. 4 stars then for In Fabric. And Ian, you're going to talk very quickly about Apollo 11.
Yeah, Apollo 11, which is a documentary about the first moon landing, culled from thousands and thousands of hours of 65mm footage that hadn't been seen before. And it's a brilliant documentary. There's no talking heads, no commentary, just a visual representation of this story. And the point where there's sort of 17 seconds where they're re-entering the atmosphere, that even though you know the outcome, is so fucking tense. It's terrific. So it's really good stuff.
Do you need to see the first 10 Apollos in order for this to make sense?
You do. You should binge the first 10 Apollos, then skip to Apollo 13.
Oh, okay? Poor Apollo 12.
But if you love your NASA movies, if you love Apollo 13, if you love First Man, it has a lot yeah. of the kind of tactile quality that First yeah. Man has as well.
Oh, okay.
So it's terrific. See, if you, I think it's showing in
biggest screen possible. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we should also shout out to Support the Girls, which
yes.
is out this week, which is about what is known as a restaurant. This is like a Hooters, if you know that chain of restaurants. It's kind of a funny kind of feminist take on comedy on those stories with Regina Hall.
Fantastic. And
so it's a really good week this week, but it was kind of in the middle of summer. You've got big things and you've got small interesting things, so it's a great week to go watch movies.
What do we give Support the Girls?
4.
And Apollo 11?
4.
Not 11 then?
No, we didn't, no.
Yeah, that's a shame. All right, so wow, you are absolutely spoiled for choice this week.
It's
so just,
right, yeah.
Just to reiterate, Spider-Man Far From Home does not open until Tuesday, but otherwise, yesterday, Support the Girls, Apollo 11, or In Fabric, you will have a good week at the movies. And that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Will Poulter, star of Ari Aster's Midsommar. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Midsommar.
You know,
yeah.
John Nettles, murders, all that sort of stuff. So very, very excited about that. But until then, until we meet again, until a auspicious occasion, it is goodbye from Ian Freer.
Bye.
It's goodbye from James Dyer.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to pitch a show to Netflix about a guy pitching a show to Netflix. Because you know what? They'll make anything at Netflix. Seriously, guys, don't listen to that bit. I love you and I respect you. Now, please give me a 10-season deal. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.